We're very happy to have Brother David and Sister Shirley back with us here in Seattle. You know, they're part of our class for so many years. It's like when you invite them back, it's like almost like a weekend coming back. So we're very happy they're here. And especially at this time, Brother David's going to serve us with the topic, Abraham. Abraham. Brother David.
Well, our convention is almost over. I know we've all had a lot of blessings that will come to us as we think about this convention, as we go home or as we retell it to others who weren't able to come. And we want to certainly thank our host, the Seattle class, for making provision for all of our needs. There's a lot of work involved. We know the planning and the organizing, the meals and so on, and our overnight arrangements, and even the weather. I don't know how they did it, but we've had sunshine and warm weather, just beautiful. So we can just sit back and relax and enjoy what has been prepared for us. I'm sure we all want to thank the class. All in favor of thanking the Seattle class. If you really like it, you raise both hands, you know. Okay, that's good. Well, anyway, thank you very much. We'll look forward to another year, maybe here or wherever the class decides to have their next convention next year. Our lesson today is not on any special doctrine, but just some thoughts about Abraham. And I don't mean Abraham Lincoln, although, you know, he was, in my book, a very great president, a very great man. I think he embodied character elements of humility and so on that I like in people. And I think that he did the best he could to unite a nation that had been split apart on the subject of slavery. But we're going to talk about a different Abraham, the one that's in the scriptures. And certainly we all are quite familiar with this wonderful character of the Old Testament. And certainly we realize that a lot of other religions claim Abraham as their founder. And we're going to pretend that maybe it's around Christmas time. And if we can imagine ourselves on the outskirts of Jerusalem in the latter part of December and are among the mass of pilgrims going into the city. And once we get inside the gates of Jerusalem, this stream of people divides. The Christians turn north because today is the last day, last Friday before Christmas. And this afternoon, monks will lead a procession carrying crosses down the Via Della Rosa to duplicate or attempt to duplicate Jesus carrying the cross for his crucifixion, assisted, of course, along the way by Simon of Cyrene. Jews will turn south. Today is the last day of Hanukkah, and at sunset, rabbis will hold a ceremony lighting candles at the Western Wall. Muslims will turn to the east. Today is the last Friday of Ramadan, and at noon, clerics will hold a prayer service with thousands bending as one. Inside this city is a huge rock. Some believe that Adam was buried here. Strictly an opinion, of course. There's no evidence or scriptures that tell us that. But we do know Solomon built a temple there. Jesus prayed there. Muhammad ascended from there. And Abraham came here to sacrifice his son. And Abraham today stands as a shared ancestor of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Abraham is symbolized by the rock of their faith. Now, when we were in Israel, we visited the rock. It's a huge thing. But unfortunately, it is hidden under a golden dome. It is my opinion, and it's just my opinion, that eventually that dome that's covering the rock will be destroyed in due time, so that the rock will be revealed to all. Because that rock, or that dome rather, represents an evil, false religion. And all such representations will be destroyed, so that in God's kingdom, there will no longer be any such things left to confuse mankind. And maybe it, that great rock, will be left to be included when and if the temple is rebuilt. There was a railing around the rock, and when we were there, I wanted to go out and touch it, but I didn't dare to touch it. Muslims were there, and I didn't want to start a riot by extending my arm beyond the railing to touch that great rock. It's magnificent in size and appearance. But mostly, its historical place in God's plan makes a person feel as if it is truly a holy place, a very fitting symbol of Abraham. And I must admit to having a sort of chill come over me as I stood there and realized what a momentous history that rock had had and its meaning for us. Well, maybe in another sense, that rock will be a reminder of the true God, rather than or in addition to it being a reminder of the great faith of Abraham and his place in God's plan of the ages. I could not help but think of it and of the many times that word rock is used to denote God. Especially David in the Psalms speaks of the Lord as a rock, and quite often. And in just as an example, in the 18th Psalm, verse 2, Psalms 18:2, it says, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God. My strength, in whom I will trust, my buckler, and the horn of my salvation, and my high tower." But getting back to Abraham, however, in going back in time, we find Abraham in the Bible. We meet him as it's recorded in Genesis, the 11th chapter. But his name wasn't Abraham. It was Abram. In Genesis 11:26, we read, "And Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran." In reading this text, it would appear that Abram was the firstborn of Terah, but that is not the case. And Brother Russell comments on this as follows. He says, "Haran, the eldest, was born to Terah when he was 70, while Abram, the youngest, was not born until Terah was 130. Abram is mentioned first because of his greater prominence. And during this 60-year period, Lot, the son of Haran, was born. And Haran died before Terah died. Lot and Abram were probably nearly the same age. What do we know about Terah's lineage? Well, just briefly, we go back to the flood. We have Noah having three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem is the line that we use to get to Terah. Shem was about the eighth son down from Shem. Then we get three sons of Terah, as we have already noted, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, we don't know if Haran got his name from an already existing location or an existing name in his day. But we see Terah going to a place called Haran, where he died after God appeared to Abram to tell him to pick up his possessions and go to a place that he would show him. And now Abram did this, but he had to wait until Terah died. And this is in Genesis 11:32. "And Terah died at the age of 205. They lived a long time in those days, didn't they? 205 years. I'm in my 89th year, and I'll tell you, I feel my age most of the time as I walk around and try to go from place to place. But here Terah lived to be 205 years before he died. And Abram had to wait until his father died. And whenever I think of this kind of sentence that Abram had to wait until his father died, I think of a brother, and I can't remember his name. I should have asked Shirley if she remembers names just like that. But anyway, this brother said that Abram had to wait until his old man died. And, you know, we use that word old man some, in many instances, in a kind way, to indicate our father. And this brother said, we have to do the same thing. We have to wait to get to New Jerusalem until our old man dies. And what he's talking about there is this old human flesh with its desires and its hopes and its ambitions and its perplexities. We have to put that old man to death, and then we can go to Jerusalem. And speaking of going to Jerusalem, we have to go to Jerusalem through Philadelphia, don't forget. You cannot get to Jerusalem without going to through Philadelphia. Now, I was born in Philadelphia, so I've got a head start on all of you. But you know what I mean. The word Philadelphia means love. And so until we get rid of the old man And then we have acquired this wonderful character element of love for one another and even for our enemies, then we can go to the New Jerusalem. In reprint 3460, Brother Russell says that Abram was 75 years old, and that's what the scripture says. He was 75 years old when Terah died. And he claims that this date of Abraham being 75 years old is exactly 2,081 years from the fall in Eden. And it's 2,081 years before Cornelius was converted. Now, I know you were waiting all this convention to know that that was the case, that Abram, at 75 years of age, was at the middle point from the sin that was committed in Eden to the time when Cornelius was converted. Now, you can go home. But I thought that was kind of an interesting side element. Now, the location Haran is mentioned in 2 Kings 19:11 as being a nation conquered by the king of Assyria. And Haran is mentioned in two places in the Bible, once in 2 Kings 19:12 and another time in Isaiah 37:12. So now we see Abram getting his instructions from God in Genesis, the 12th chapter, verses 1 to 3. And there we read, "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show unto thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." Now, in this statement, there are seven elements in these verses 2 and 3. One is that he's going to make of Abraham a great nation. Secondly, he said, "I will bless thee." Third, he said, "I'm going to make thy name great." And then fourthly, he says, "I will make, thou shalt be a blessing." Fifth, he says, "I will curse him that curseth thee, and bless them that bless thee." And seventh, he says, "In thee shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." Now, when Abram is given these seven promises, a question comes to mind. Why did God select him? We know very little about him. He arrives on the scene with no mention of his mother. We know nothing of his childhood. He comes to us suddenly, sometime before Terah dies, and is given a promise by God. Now, he evidently told Terah about it because they move from the land of Ur and they go to Haran, where Terah dies at the age of 205. Some experts say that Iraq is the land of Ur that Abraham left, and Haran is somewhere in the south part of Turkey. But that's just one man's opinion. We don't know whether that's correct or not. So when we read or hear about Iraq, it's possible that this might have been the birthplace of Abram. Now, Abram is 75 years old, and he starts out on this journey led by God towards Canaan. And while waiting for a place to settle, he travels quite a bit south, eventually going as far as Egypt. And it was while he was traveling through Canaan that God gave him that land specifically, saying in Genesis 12, verses 6 and 7, Genesis 12, 6 and 7, and it says, "And Abram passed through the land unto the land of Sichem in the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thee, unto thy seed rather, will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him." And a question comes to mind. Did God have a right to give the land to Abram and his seed? Why not just drive the Canaanites and then say to Abram, "This is your land"? Yes, God had a right to make that statement to Abram. In the 24th Psalm, we read verse 1, a Psalm of David. It says, "The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein." So the land, the whole earth, is the Lord's. Yes, he can give it to whom he pleases. Now, it's due to a famine in the land that Abram goes to Egypt and then returns and settles there. And it is at this time that he and Lot separate because their flocks were just too great to just settle in one location. Then we have Lot taken a prisoner and all his goods. And one of Lot's people evidently escape, and they go to Abram. Abram goes and rescues Lot, and he brings him and all his goods back to where Lot was living. And here is the first time that the scriptures speak of Abram being a Hebrew. In Genesis 14, verse 13, Genesis 14, verse 13, we read, "And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and the brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram." And it's here also that Abram meets Melchizedek, and Melchizedek blesses him as he was the priest of God, the Most High. And it is here that we get a lesson from Abram. We find that Abram does not take any of the spoil for himself, nor does he take credit for the victory, but thanks God for it. He refuses to take even a thread or a sandal strap. And this pleases God so much that the Lord appears to him in a vision and he says, "Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward." And that's a good example for all of us. But Abram speaks to God and asks for children. After all, he was promised a seed, which God had said he would have. And God responds with these words. He says, "Look up in the sky Your seed will be as the stars of heaven. And Abram believed God, and God accounted it to him for righteousness. Genesis 15, verses 5 and 6. Genesis 15, verses 5 and 6. But the time passes, and Sarah, thinking to help God along, says to Abram, "Take my maid Hagar and have a child by her." Of course, later Sarah sort of changes her mind about this arrangement that she herself has suggested, and she drives Hagar out of her sight. But the angel of the Lord tells Hagar to go back, and she goes back and eventually gives birth to a son, and his name is called Ishmael. Abram now is 86 years old. In time, Abram is 99 years old, and God appears to him. This is Genesis, the 17th chapter, verse 1. Genesis 17, 1. And he renews his covenant with Abram. And it is here that God changes Abram's name to Abraham. And this name means father of many. By now, Ishmael is 13 years old. Then when Abraham is 100, Sarah bears him a son, and he is called Isaac. So now we go to another major event in the life of Abraham. This involves the calling by God to Abraham to sacrifice his son, Isaac. This is in Genesis, the 22nd chapter, verses 1 to 12. The question comes to mind as to how old is Isaac at this time? Well, some illustrations show Isaac as being just a small child. But this seems hardly right, considering that Isaac is the one who carried the wood for the fire. A child would hardly be able to do that. And Josephus says that Isaac was 25 at this time, while the Talmud proposes 33 as his age. And this would kind of fit Jesus' age when he was crucified. Another theory is that Sarah was 90 when he was born, and she was 127 when she died. And her death is given in the next chapter, and some feel that this experience of Abraham taking Isaac, her son, as a sacrifice was too much for her, and her death followed. Therefore, he may have been 37 at that time. At any rate, he was a grown man. Now comes God's instructions about this event. This is Genesis 22, verses 1 and 2. It says, "It came to pass after these things that God did tempted Abraham, and said unto Abraham, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains, which I will tell thee of." Now, in reading this carefully, I could not help but notice that God does not specifically say to Abraham that he is to kill Isaac. He simply says he is to offer him as a sacrifice. And this is important in view of certain other statements of scriptures. One we have already touched upon, that Abram's seed would become a great nation. Genesis 12, 1 and 2. Also, when going up to the mountain, you remember, he tells the two men who were with Abraham and Isaac, and this is in Genesis 22, verse 5, and Abram said unto his young men, abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And the New King James Version says, we will both return unto you. Abraham is so full of faith that he is fully expects that both will return, and evidently does not expect that Isaac will be killed. Then in another text, in verse 7, says, Isaac spake unto Abraham his father. And he said, father. And he said, here I am. Here I am, my son. And he said, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide. So here again, we have Abraham, because of God's previous promise to make his seed as the stars of heaven and the sand upon the seashore, believes that somehow God will intervene, which shows great faith and trust in God, of course. And that's another lesson for us. God has made us certain promises, and God will fulfill them regardless of the appearance of where we might be going. In reading carefully, we can see how Abraham was first of all tested, and then Isaac was only to be offered as a sacrifice, but that God would provide his own sacrifice. At no time does God ask Abraham to kill Isaac. One could say that it is implied, yes, but that is not the case. In view of the fact that much later, in talking about how some other faiths, like the Muslims possibly and others, were sacrificing children to Molech, God says it never entered into his mind to do such a thing. In Jeremiah 19, verse 5, it said, they have built also the high places of Baal to burn their sons with fire for burnt offerings unto Baal, which I commanded not, nor spake it, neither came it into my mind. God said, it never entered into my mind to have Abraham kill Isaac. And so we see that when he said, you bring him up here and offer him as a sacrifice, it did not mean that he would kill him. It meant that he would just make that offer. He was being tested. This was a great principle with God, that he condemned the practice of those who worshiped Baal and offered up their children in sacrifice. So the principle is very plain. God said through Jeremiah, he never commanded it, neither spake it, neither did it come to his mind. So in order to be harmonious with the event in Abraham's life, we have to accept the fact that God never told Abraham to kill Isaac. The Apostle Paul refers to this in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17, Hebrews 11, 17, that by faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence he received him in a figure. Paul thought maybe he might die, but that God would raise him up again. What Paul is saying is God was making a type, a figure. God never intended to have Abraham kill Isaac. Yes, Abraham did bind Isaac. Yes, he placed him on the altar. Yes, he took his hand and his knife, almost ready to slay his son. But God stopped him. As a result of Abraham's willingness to do what God asked of him, God stays his hand and makes that wonderful covenant, which is such a blessing to us all. In Genesis 22, verse 15, it says, "And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time, and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed, as the stars of the heaven, and the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice." We see how well Isaac prefigured Jesus in a number of ways. Both were born outside the natural scope of events. Both births were announced by angels. The Gospels even set the date of Jesus' death at Passover, the same time that Jewish interpreters placed the offering of Isaac. No wonder Abraham is considered as the great rock to all of us of faith in God and in his promises. You're here already.
I'm sorry.
Wow. Anyway, my dear brethren, we see a wonderful arrangement of God. He made it a figure. He performed the antitype with Jesus. We can't go into detail about that. But one thing in closing I want to say is that, my dear brethren, the time is short. We are living in that transition time. The days seem dark for the world, and they're going to get worse, I'm sorry to say. But there must be a time when all mankind will cry out to God for help. And there shall be no man that can solve the problems of this transition time. God has promised that it will be a short time, and then he will say, "Peace, be still." The only thing that is needed is for the church to be completed. Then that short time of trouble, and then will come peace and the still small voice of God. Sister Esther Chaloux gave me a little page that I would like to read in closing. "I may never see tomorrow. There's no written guarantee. And things that happened yesterday belong to history. I cannot predict the future. I cannot change the past. I have just this present moment. I must treat it as my last. I must use this moment wisely, for it soon will pass away and be lost to me forever as part of yesterday. I must exercise compassion. Help the fallen to their feet. Be a friend unto the friendless. Make an empty life complete. The unkind things I do today may never be undone. And friendships that I failed to win may never be won. I may not have another chance on bended knee to pray and thank God with humble heart for giving me this day. Amen.